Sorry, can I blow my nose?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go for it.
Sorry, guys.
That is a good, that's a good, literal cold open. Cold open.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. I hope everyone enjoyed the holidays and our pre-recorded podcast episodes. We are very much back to the current news cycle this week. Last Thursday, the Pentagon announced that the United States killed Iran's Major General Qasem Soleimani at the direction of the president in an airstrike in Iraq. Iran has vowed retaliation, and we are now waiting to see what form that will take. Elections are our focus, not foreign policy, so we're going to talk about how the current conflict or any further escalation could reshape the dynamics of the 2020 election. And here with me to do that, back from vacation, our editor-in-chief Nate Silver. How's it going?
I'll have you know I am an expert
in foreign policy,
in Iranian politics, as of about 3 days ago.
So are a lot of people in my newsfeed. Yeah.
Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. How's it going?
It's good, Galen.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Very good.
Nate, do you want to put on your headphones? I'm like, honestly, I kind of don't need them, but.
Yeah, I don't really. Yeah. You know, it's been a while since I did this.
It has been.
For all of us.
Man, been a while.
Yeah, like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I missed you guys.
I missed you too, Micah.
I would have missed you if I wasn't ruining my vacation working on the f-ing model.
Yeah.
It didn't ruin the vacation. I had a good vacation.
Anyway, let's talk about the conflict with Iran. As I mentioned, a U.S. drone killed Qasem Soleimani last week. He was the head of Iran's Revolutionary Quds Force for 2 decades, a paramilitary organization, and he was arguably the second most powerful military official in the country. The airstrike also killed 9 other people, including deputy commander of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. We have often mentioned on this podcast that American voters are not particularly attuned to foreign policy. What does it take for international politics to eclipse domestic issues in an election and refocus voters' attention? Does where things stand right now rise to that level?
I think a conflict with Iran rises to the level of perhaps taking precedence in or raising the prominence of foreign policy in election, in part because of the United States' history with Iran, which obviously dates back to active involvement by the CIA with with the Shah, and then obviously the American hostage crisis in Tehran, and going into sort of the entangled politics, frankly, of the Persian Gulf, right? The shifting alliances or the tangled alliances of Saudi and Iran and like Qatar and the UAE and like oil. So this is all super important to the world economy, to a region that is highly flammable. And also Americans' involvement in Middle Eastern wars is obviously a huge emotional specter among the electorate. I think it doesn't take much to have a presidential candidates be talking about an ongoing conflict with, you know, what we once and still do label kind of as part of the axis of evil, right? That was the George W. Bush way of framing it. So I think this is a big deal.
Yeah. Micah and Nate, do you see this as upending the dynamics of the 2020 election?
Not yet. But it feels like it has the potential to, depending on how it develops, surely. I think already you're seeing it break through in a way that other foreign policy stories have not. Upending is obviously a high bar, right?
Yeah.
And I guess we should talk about it a little bit to what extent it is an all or nothing question in terms of foreign policy and domestic electoral politics.
Yeah.
But this definitely, you know, it's scary and it does feel like it has the potential to overwhelm things.
The one thing I'll say, too, which is Nate was joking about this earlier, you know, everyone in your Twitter feed becomes a Middle East expert when something happens in the Middle East. And I don't purport to be one of those people. I did live in the region for a couple of years. But what I will say that I find a little bit, you know, when we're talking about incidents that could affect an election, we often talked during 2016 in particular about terrorist attacks, right? Things that could be, frankly, like tragic October surprises, things that can really upend dynamics. In the 2016 election, Trump's Muslim ban came on the heels of a domestic ISIS-inspired attack in California. And one of the hallmarks of the Iranian regime and the Quds Force that Soleimani ran, right, is that they sometimes pair with groups that are quicker, more agile, terrorist organizations, right? So the idea that, like, yes, the American military is much more powerful than the Iranian military writ large is very true. But I also think places where Americans travel freely or have up until whatever, a week ago, are all of a sudden kind of yikes spots. So so I think that is kind of this escalation that I see as like a true question mark of like what happens.
A lot of unknown elements.
A lot of unknown elements.
In terms of how things escalate.
Of retaliation,
Nate, what's your view here?
You know, one way to say when does the public get interested is when there's some element of fear involved. Certainly when there's an element of American troops being deployed, which we're a long way away from. You know, I mean, this attack was, I don't know how to characterize it, right? The strike. The drone
it was
strike.
I mean, can I say something?
Yeah.
Just from like a semantics point of view as a journalist, I'm comfortable saying it was an assassination. I don't think we do our listeners or readers any favors by saying like,
I mean, I think there is some dispute over whether if it's in a war, then he is an enemy combatant.
And that's what the Obama administration maintained for years, right?
It's
this
drones,
was part of an ongoing, some widening.
And we should also point out the Obama drone program was incredibly controversial for that exact reason of, again, I would say there's an artifice of saying like,
We're all the time, everywhere, and therefore,
as a journalist, I just feel like, and frankly, and I'm glad Nate is raising this because I think there's certainly room for difference. My point of view on it is, if we can't say it, who can, right? I'm not here to hold the U.S. government line on this.
Well, yeah, so we're like it's either an assassination or we're at war, right? You can't, but one of those two things has to be true.
Yeah.
Happy Monday.
Monday. First Monday in 2020, actually, back from vacation.
The epiphany, January 6th.
But this was not a case where you saw, as in the case of Bin Laden or something, you did not see like people characterize it or the news media characterize it as, oh, we just offed terrorist leader, right? It got a different reaction. I think a YouGov poll had reaction about evenly split, you know, a third approve, a third disapprove, and a third aren't sure yet, which is not typically the reaction you get if you had killed some terrorist leader or something. So there is like already signs of some degree of trepidation.
To me, that is the big question here is, it's very hard to anticipate how the public will respond to this, in particular if it escalates. And the big question, I think, is to what extent does Trump, because of his behavior, because of his history, not get the benefit of the doubt from a section of Americans? And I don't just mean Democrats. You know, historically, in situations like this, there's a rally around the flag effect, at least in some cases. The president has some advantages when sort of wielding the instruments of foreign
policy.
In terms of domestic political affairs, right? The numbers Nate just cited get at this, and I think we could have anticipated this to some extent. But there is a question to which I wonder whether there be some Americans who view this not as Trump acting decisively, but as, is this just a mess Trump created, basically?
Yeah.
You know, or some combination of the two.
The thing that I've been interested in over the weekend as I've watched kind of the discourse unfold, the obvious parallel here, or the parallel that people are coming to, is the Iraq War, right? And the way that the Iraq War was sold, spun, if we're being sort of crass, but I don't think we are, right? The way that like patriotism was kind of made partisan during the aughts. You know, full disclosure, I was, you know, a teenager. I was in high school when we went into the Iraq War. So like, I was paying attention, but not fully. But I do remember that as this very powerful cultural force. And so there were a lot of people saying, essentially, this is how a war is sold, right? It's essentially like the rally around the flag effect, right? That this is how people gain momentum. And my question about that is that too facile a comparison for the times in which we live? I mean, I kept on seeing the AP retweeting or making it a news story that Rose McGowan, who is an actress with, as far as I know, no foreign policy experience, being like, I apologize, like, I'm sorry that we're attacking you, Iran. And I was like, first of all, this is like kind of a weird thing for the AP to be promoting. But it's an interesting liberal sentiment that I do think there was an undercurrent, maybe not to the extreme of Rose McGowan, but of like, I can't believe Trump is doing this. What are we getting into? In various degrees, Rose McGowan being, frankly, the stupidest kind of version of that, but one that existed on Twitter, to the smarter takes, which were Soleimani was a malevolent actor. But obviously, this is like a huge escalation. What is Trump doing? None of our allies are with us. Is this just like the Iraq War minus any coalition of the willing, to bring back some early aughts terminology?
And that was pretty solidly the view from the candidates in the Democratic primary.
So to go back to it, is like, my question is the Iraq War necessarily the best comparison? Because we do maybe live in more of a hard, like, I have a harder time seeing the rally around the flag effect from, I don't know, 50% of the country.
Yeah, I want to get into all of that in just a minute. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Calm. They say it takes 2 months to form a habit. And if you're making a resolution this year, that can feel like a long time to wait to see results. With Calm, all it takes is 5 minutes a day to feel better, calmer, and ready to face whatever this year throws at you. Calm is the number one app for sleep, relaxation, and meditation. Calm has sleep stories, which are like bedtime stories for adults. They can help you fall into a deep, natural sleep in minutes, and stories are narrated by iconic voices like LeVar Burton and Nick Offerman. They also have soothing music from artists like Sam Smith, guided meditations, breathing exercises, and so much more to help you relax and de-stress. Over 60 million people use Calm. Join them today to accomplish your goals tomorrow. For listeners, Calm is offering a special limited-time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/538. That's 40% off, unlimited access to Calm's entire library, and new content is added every week. Get started today at calm.com/538. Again, that's calm.com/538. All right, we're back, and both Claire and Micah, you brought up this rally around the flag theory that basically says when there's an international crisis or war that the president sees their approval go up. I want to kind of talk broadly about the risks here for President Trump, both ranging from a rally around the flag effect, which would be, it's crass, but like a positive effect of this on his domestic political standing, to some of the downsides of this potentially for Trump. So let's start with the rally around the flag. Does it seem like we're in a situation today where the American public is willing to get on board with the president in a conflict with Iran, or are things different than they might have been for Bush, even when the public really... You did see his approval go up around the Iraq invasion and
9/11. So I think things are clearly different now. The more things escalate in a conflict, the more I think we would have to take less for granted about how much those differences will affect the reaction among Americans, which is to say that I don't think we should rule out, if something really extreme develops, partisan lines breaking down, for example.
What do you mean? Predictions were made before and always been, you know.
Wait, but what do you mean by something extreme? Like, say,
like a hostage,
Iran,
like a hostage
Iran
crisis
responds
like
to
if there's
this,
yeah,
like, by attacking American citizens and exactly, not military.
Exactly right. You hate to get into it, but yeah, if there's a very right now in the story, there are Democrats and Republicans actually on both sides sort of saying, what are we doing here? What's going on here? Oh, no, actually, this is the right move, or this is the right move at the wrong time, or why now? Or it's just a muddled picture, right? If there's a development, an extreme development, like an attack that is not muddled, that is crystal clear, then I wouldn't want to predict what would happen, right? But as a starting assumption, I think we'd have to say, okay, partisanship is stronger now. That would make it less likely we'd see any rally around the flag effect. I think there's evidence for that. You know, we saw a rally around the flag effect when bin Laden was killed for Obama, but it wasn't that big.
Well, we weren't attacked here, or at least not in the way that most Americans would consider an attack, although Iran had been escalating in various ways, right? I mean, that's one big difference. And another big difference is the lack of trust in Trump. And a third difference is like the fatigue after Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, for many years, like, people have been trepidatious in polls about further foreign entanglements, period, especially in the Middle East.
To me, that's the most interesting element in some ways of this Trump deciding to escalate and to assassinate Soleimani, is that he campaigned on getting out of the Middle East and no more wars. And what I think has been, so, you know, we've watched the Democratic candidates in one form or another say, bad move, Trump. Bernie Sanders, I think, is always incredibly attuned to in his, he does this in debates and he did this in his response to this attack. He'll say, this was Trump's promise. He is breaking this promise with this. And I will say that I think like Sanders has the best sense for that, like going back to 2016 and sort of replaying the tape and saying, remember this, he did that, right? Like he went against his promise.
I guess I think that, yes, Trump campaigned in 2016 in part on a more isolationist foreign policy, and in particular on being less willy-nilly about wielding American military.
Hillary the hawk, Donald the dove, in the words of Maureen Dowd.
Exactly, right. I don't.
Who I love, by the way. I don't want to sh** on Maureen Dowd. She's.
I love Rose McGowan, so okay. You take Dowd, I'll take McGowan.
All right, I'll take neither.
So, okay, so yes, Trump campaigned on that. Do I think those stances played like a causal role in his support in the way that like his immigration positions did? Not really. So I wonder if Trump all of a sudden is advocating a really interventionist foreign policy, I wonder if we would see public opinion sort of revert back to post-Iraq war, like immediate post-Iraq invasion, somewhere around there, where Democrats are split or against, or maybe really against, and Republicans are more in favor.
Yeah, I mean, what do you two think on that question of can President Trump, through the force of partisanship and his personality, bring Republicans along for the ride after there's been significant opposition to foreign intervention post-Iraq war?
I don't know. I think it's a little bit of a climb. I mean, I think, you know, Bush was incredibly unpopular when he left office, in part because of the financial cost of getting into a war in the Middle East. The conservatives didn't like that, right? In addition to the fact that, like, you know, I think the emotional effects of seeing essentially like certain classes in America being the ones who serve in the military and suffer the effects of the opioid crisis. And right, there's like there's redounding effects of being at war for 20 years and it being a particular class of American who bears the brunt of that. And so that to me like gets into Trumpism too. So like fiscal conservatives were pissed off at Bush for having gotten into the Iraq war. But I also think like Trump conservatives are pissed off at foreign interventions. I shouldn't say pissed off, ticked off at foreign interventions because it's an emotional effect of why are we sending all of these people to the Middle East? I think like Trump can probably bring along a certain amount of the Republican base, but I do think it's an uphill climb because we've had 20 years of pretty much a lot of people in politics being against interventionist wars. I mean, Obama, if you read a lot of like Samantha Power critiques, right, like didn't get involved where some people thought he should have in Syria, for instance, right? And like in sort of what people saw as humanitarian crises, in part because Obama ran on, I didn't vote for the war in Iraq. I didn't vote for these wars in the Middle East. I'm here to get you out. Like that has been, for the past decade of American politics, let's get out of the Middle East, has been the campaign line. And then presidents have, of course, faced the reality of, whoa, if we pull out,
what's gonna
happen? And I think we saw the effect of ISIS.
Nick, what do you think here? Do you think that Trump can bring public opinion along for the ride with him at this point?
I mean, he said trouble moving public opinion in his favor on much of anything, which is probably true for presidents in general these days, I think. I mean, look, if you want to be kind of gross about it, I mean, if like we were to be attacked by Iran in a way that, you know, was considered a terrorist attack or something that was very shocking, then that might increase support for, you know, further escalation.
And there's precedents for that,
yeah.
Right? Beirut, Tehran, and the like. There's like lots of precedents for this. So I don't think we're being.
No.
It's.
I mean, I don't know that Iran wants war, right? So they kind of have this weird imperative where they have to show they're tough, but on the other hand, they like kind of want to do something that's like maybe not super high profile. I don't know.
So we've been talking about some potential reasons that Trump may not be able to bring public opinion along with him, some potential downsides for this escalation. Maybe let's talk about some possible upsides. I mean, so since President Trump himself brought it up back in 2011, Trump said that he expected President Obama to start a war with Iran in order to win re-election. You know, and he said it in videos, he said it on tweets repeatedly. Obviously, Obama didn't do that. But, you know, again, since President Trump brought it up, does that seem like a wise political strategy to start a war to win re-election?
No.
No. And I also think we should question it morally, but I mean...
Oh, excuse me?
That's a different podcast.
No, to go back to all the reasons why wars in the Middle East are not popular, right? That's my gut.
No. And I agree. I think that's right. I think selling a war, particularly a war in the Middle East, is harder now than it was because people were burned by Iraq, were burned by other conflicts. I wonder if it's not quite as uphill as we think, given the years that have passed. But anyway, first of all, to start a war, if you're perceived as starting a war, my guess would be that will certainly not help you politically. And I think that's part of Trump's problem here is the storyline is a little muddled, right? When Trump responded, when he launched missiles against Syria after the Syrian president used chemical weapons, he was roundly sort of lauded for that response, right? That isn't the case here. The particulars are a bit more in question, right?
They say it was preemptive, but the details about what kind of attack was expected on American interests have not been forthcoming.
Yeah. And this is someone who has been involved in this stuff, including attacks on American interests for years and years and years and years, right? And so that makes it harder for Trump. But let's talk, okay, would it help Trump electorally to be involved in a military conflict that's perceived more favorably in the U.S.? In other words, to go back to what we were saying before, let's say there is an attack that's shocking on U.S. soil that is viewed by the American people as a clearer justification for military action. Would that help him electorally? Possibly. I think even then Trump has this issue of trust, of do Americans, do independents, do certainly Democrats, I think, will be a tough to impossible sell, but
I think it's kind of an uncomfortable thing to talk about because we are talking about, let me propose two scenarios. One is, let's just talk about the six swing states that we all really care about. Trump's actions in the past couple of days, how do those play with the six swing states? Well, right now, I kind of think it's not, I could see some reluctant Trump voters being this guy, what's he doing?
Yeah.
But if there's attack where U.S. citizens or a leader, a government official, whatever it is killed, it is easier for me to see that effect. And I think it's you're listening to us in this podcast kind of feel squeamish and it's such a macabre thing to talk about. But this is almost just the real politique of it, right? That this is what we saw in the Iraq War, right? Is that from September 2001 to March 2003, when the invasion of Iraq happened, I think that's right, we migrated countries. We saw justifications happen in the news, but it was all based on this emotional thing of we have been attacked. And so I think that's the power. That's the...
Well, and supporting those military actions was used as a political cudgel.
Sure.
In House elections, Senate elections.
See Hillary Clinton,
presidential elections.
I think she regretted that vote.
Micah, you were mentioning that Trump is beginning from a position where Americans don't necessarily trust him on foreign policy and being a commander in chief. But can you get into the details a little bit more? Where are the lines drawn? Is it Democrats don't trust him and Republicans do, or is it worse on foreign policy?
I mean, that's not a bad starting point, as on most issues. I do think that, and the polling bears this out, Trump, because his behavior has been erratic, because his rhetoric has been kind of all over the place at times, starts with a disadvantage relative to your average president in terms of selling the public on I think on this. Now, the particulars matter, right, as we've been saying all along. How this develops really will have a huge effect on how it plays out electorally. But I just think Trump just has a marginal disadvantage within that. But again, who knows? There was a lot of coverage, for example, about Trump said he would attack cultural sites within Iran. And I saw a lot of media coverage of that would be a war crime. You know, if that's the argument people are having, then I could kind of see Trump getting the better of it. You know, if Trump is talking about killing terrorists and the media, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying if the public perceives Trump's opponents as worried about cultural sites, you get what I mean? Like, I think
it's an easy way to paint. Look at those softy.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah. The Rose McGowan thing plays into that too.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of, well, yes, correct.
I'm not even saying it's intentional, but he does have this knack for kind of like
right. I think
finding the soft spots.
I think what all these things come back to is like to use the language of the 20th century, it's the emasculization or the macho-ness all coming into play, right? You're a wimp, I'm not. And like that's kind of how a lot of this stuff in politics happens is people, politicians, get afraid of seeming wimpy. And I wish it were more complicated than that, but it's kind of not.
No,
and I do think, like, to Micah's point, it really plays into Trump's strength, which is, as we all know, calling people wimpy and people being afraid of being called wimpy in public by Trump in crasser ways or whatever. And I think that's powerful when American power and the sense of American exceptionalism is attached to that, oh, you're a wimp.
Yeah. Although, I mean, on the flip side here, as you mentioned in part, Micah, when we've seen polling of how will President Trump deal with an international crisis, you know, does he have the temperament to be commander in chief? He is starting from, that's one of his weaker positions, right? That has been, that was a message that Hillary Clinton was talking about for all of 2016. And it seems to, looking at the polling here, be something that has stuck to a certain degree. You know, you have 24% of Americans saying that he would be very good at dealing with an international crisis, right? Whereas on the flip side, you have a large majority saying he would do a very poor job of dealing with an international crisis.
Yeah.
So we will see how this all plays out. And of course, the closer it gets to patriotic, emotional, macho issues that you're talking about, you can imagine that changing, but in this moment.
Well, and also just to say it out loud, if this plays out and it's viewed as being handled really well, then because he's so bad on these numbers to start, that could have a huge benefit politically for Trump. Because then all of a sudden it's like, this is like, okay, he has been criticized, as you said, from the beginning. How will this erratic person handle the country in a moment of true crisis, right? If he's perceived as handling it well, then all of a sudden they pair that with a good economy and then, you know.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. All right. So to wrap things up, I want to talk about how this affects the Democratic primary. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Upstart. Between hitting the gym, eating healthier, and learning a new skill, there's a lot of ways we can better ourselves in the new year. One key way is by starting off the year tackling high-interest credit card debt. And Upstart.com is here to help with that. Upstart is the revolutionary lending platform that offers smarter rates to help pay off high-interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional credit score when assessing your credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter rate. Upstart believes you're more than just your credit score. They make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rate. The best part, once the loan is approved and accepted, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 400,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards or meet their financial goals. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes. That's upstart.com/politics. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as national security advisors just for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions, professional-grade systems for commercial-grade businesses. Businesses choose ADT Commercial. The Fortune 1000 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Businesses choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit ADT.com/538 to learn more. Again, that's ADT.com/538. We're back, and we've already seen the contenders for the Democratic nomination talking about President Trump's actions with regards to Iran and either stressing their foreign policy credentials or talking about the risks of war on the campaign trail. So let's get a little bit more specific. How will this current conflict and any possible escalation play into the strengths and weaknesses of the top contenders that we're looking at?
Good news for Biden.
Yeah, I mean, so the simplest take is that Biden is seen as by far the most trusted candidate on foreign policy, that voters are not going to be terribly interested in parsing the details, something they don't know that much about. And so therefore, they would tend to resolve debates in Biden's favor. By the way, one of the things that helps, I think, Biden and maybe also Bernie is the fact that this is going to take attention away from the campaign. And therefore, if there are fewer news cycles, there's less time for one of these somewhat self-fulfilling media surges or bounces. And so therefore, if you're one of the front runners, and they are, I think, pretty clearly in that order now, Biden, Bernie, 1-2, and then a gap between 2 and 3, I think you're pretty happy, maybe not about what we're doing in Iran, but you're, I think, okay with the fact that, like, we're not having as many campaign cycles about, like, oh, the latest Seltzer poll when there is serious stuff going on elsewhere. But, like, I should say, too, Bernie clearly has the most clearly articulated position, right? Where it's like, this is bad. This is an assassination. We have no business doing this. I always vote against all these wars that these other guys already always vote for, right? So, like, there is clarity in Bernie's message. I think there's a little bit of a fine line between, like, some of the kind of old school critique of, like, lefties who are too weak on foreign policy and stuff like that. I think Bernie has to be a little wary of that, although he does have an angle that I think is maybe more persuasive to voters who were on the fence, which is reminding people that Joe Biden voted for the Iraq war, even though Biden kind of weirdly kind of denies it. I mean, it's, you know, it's part of the congressional record. We know how he voted, right? And has not really given a great response to it. Maybe people don't care that much, but it does make that more relevant. So if I were advising Bernie, I'd say focus on Biden's vote in Iraq and other places and don't necessarily try and get too woke about how you describe the attack and so forth, because that I think is not, you know, like a lot of things Bernie's going to appeal to his base, but we still face this problem for Bernie that, like, he's got to get beyond the 18% he is now at some point. And so how do you reach out to the next 5% or 10%?
In that debate in the Democratic primary between this means you should vote for the person with the most foreign policy experience, or this means you should vote for the person who won't bring us into never-ending wars, which camp wins?
I think it'll come down to how valid the Trump actions are seen by the public. The more legitimacy they're ascribed with, the more I think foreign policy trust, the candidate Biden, who has more foreign policy experience and therefore confidence from the American people, the more that's an advantage. The more Trump's actions are seen as muddled or as, you know, a self-created crisis, then I think the more pure anti-Trump, anti-intervention message will win out.
I mean, I think none of the Democrats were shy about criticizing, having pretty harsh statements. You know, I mean, there's kind of semantics about, like, do you call it an assassination or not? Do you say at first, hey, this was a really bad guy or not, right?
Right.
Apparently some people got mad at Elizabeth Warren for kind of saying, hey, he's a really bad guy, but this was terrible that we did this in this way, right? That was like, you know, that's where I would not want to fight my ground if I were Sanders or Warren or something, right? But yeah, they were like pretty unhedged.
I guess Biden Biden wasn't all that hedged.
He threw a match into a tinderbox. That's kind of the way he described it.
I guess I give slight advantage to Biden, although I think it's a hard question to answer because I do actually think Sanders has, like, a, in the age of Trump, saying Trump didn't keep his promise, I'm here to keep you out of Middle Eastern wars, which is what Trump promised to do. That's a powerful line.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I do think the fact that, like, this attack has such a complicated effect in the international community, right? It's Iran no longer holding to the nuclear deal. It's the potential for all these attacks. It's lack of stability in Lebanon and Saudi, like, just like all over. It's all these, like, really complicated things where Biden could make this case of, like, hey, it's super complicated. I know all these people. I was part of all these things. You should probably put me in, right? It goes back to his steady at the till. Like, you may not love me the most, but yeah. I'm the best guy for the job right now.
And specifically, CNN pulled this in November and asked, which of the Democratic contenders do you most trust on foreign policy? 48% said Biden, 14% said Bernie. So just comparing those two, I mean, the voters are pretty clear on who they see as stronger on foreign policy.
And we should say, the last Democratic primary, Sanders was like hugely dinged for having no real foreign policy experience. Obviously, he was running against a former Secretary of State, but I think, I mean, he's certainly done a lot in the last 4 years to, I think, like, mature his staff and mature his, probably his knowledge on that. But I still think, like, in my mind, when I think Bernie Sanders and foreign policy, the thing that comes to mind is, frankly, a new stance on Israel, you know, the stance in the Democratic Party that's still kind of controversial, which is more critical of Israel. But that's the thing that comes to mind for me for foreign policy and Bernie, not my stance on the Iran nuclear deal.
Or also just anti-interventionism in
Correct.
General.
Correct. Yeah.
Do you guys buy it all? I think it was in the New York Times had an article about Buttigieg and the Buttigieg campaign playing up his experience in the military as a potential advantage now that foreign policy has become a bigger subject.
So not only, by the way, not only was there that singular article, but also in an article about how all the Democratic candidates were responding to the attack, they talked about Buttigieg at an event bringing up his military service and saying in the article, Mr. Buttigieg, who referred several times to his own service in the military. Like, it's kind of, there's a little bit of like, maybe I'm reading it with a bias, but that seems to be a bit kind of like someone pointing out the sort of like, absurdity is the wrong word, but like a 37-year-old guy trying to compare his time in the military to Joe Biden's time as vice president is an interesting...
I mean...
I think there is a difference between being a foreign policy expert and operating on the high levels of diplomatic circles and being in the military.
No, absolutely. Okay, but there are two separate issues here. There's like, what is actually good and useful experience? Yeah.
And what does the public view?
Exactly,
those
right.
Things?
And certainly having actually served in the military can't help but be really useful and valuable experience for being the commander-in-chief, right?
Like, he's better off with that experience and without, right? But is that making people think about, like, is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana?
So that's the thing. It's like, I agree. I tend to think if it's going to be anything, it would be an advantage. And I certainly think in, like, the real world, it actually is an advantage just in terms of actual experience.
Yeah.
But my guess would be that it's completely outweighed by the fact that he's, like, a 37-year-old guy who's from a mayor of a small town.
He can lay extremely valid claim to the emotional stuff that we were talking about before, right? Which is, these wars are, he's of a generation and he has served, frankly, outside the typical class system of the military, right? Like, the people who fight America's wars are generally not the educational and socioeconomic class of Pete Buttigieg is, right? So he lays claim to that. Yeah, in a valid way. And I think that is powerful. But I do think, I'm thinking about a debate stage, the next debate stage, where Biden and Buttigieg are talking about Iran.
Right.
And I have a very easy time picturing the exchange between Biden kind of affably doing, he does this thing where he kind of affably laughs while he kind of like zings a little
bit. I helped negotiate the nuclear deal that Trump ripped up.
It's the old Reagan line of, I won't hold my opponent's youth and inexperience against him.
The funny thing is, though, is I actually think, like, okay, that exchange, when it happens, I think Buttigieg will probably do okay in, because he will be able to say, I served. I know what it's like, you know. His problem is really anybody who's watching with the volume turned off.
All the people who aren't watching.
Or all the people who aren't watching, right. It's really just more of like a superficial image thing. And not so superficial, Nick. It's an experience thing, as Claire was saying, too, where you have the split screen of this, you know, Washington vet with years of experience. It's like, maybe this is another thing where this story, the more it stays at the center of the political conversation, does it help assuage or lessen age as a potential trip factor for Biden, you know?
And by the way, I will say, foreign policy, and in particular American military interventions are, I do think, a place where Biden feels like vocational about his decision to run for president this time around. And what, like, when I have seen him on the trail, the times when he truly like gets his Irish up is when he is talking about America's interventions. He, you know, over the summer he was at a press gaggle and he pulled out like a piece of paper and he was like, I get the number of American troops who have like casualties and deaths every single morning in a briefing, right? Like, this is a thing I care about. And it was this moment where, like, you know, candidates, when they're answering questions, kind of have, there's like a certain, you can tell like, oh, this is the talking point, and they're just putting it out there. This was like a moment when he was very, very animated. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that this particular issue is one where he's just like, his resume is his strength, but two, I think it's the issue where he probably feels like this is the reason why I'm running, mm-hmm. right? Is that like, I do for, if I'm going to be like a bridge between Trump and whatever comes after Trump, this is why I would be there, right? Is the experience, is the kind of like being the Band-Aid over the trouble.
The other potential, again, it feels so crass to say this, but the other potential advantage Biden has is part of what a lot of people connect to in Biden is he has led a life that has been like just like in this horrible way marked by tragedy, especially in terms of his family. And so he is really, in I think a genuine way, really good at connecting with people when there is a tragedy, a public tragedy too, right? And kind of, you know, that more emotional part of politics. So when you're talking about a story that has life or death stakes, that can't help but be a useful tool for his campaign.
Yeah.
And just to add a little more kind of details to the numbers I gave before from this CNN poll in November, you know, Pete Buttigieg was at 6% of people saying that they trust him the most on foreign policy, with Elizabeth Warren at 11%. And foreign policy was the one area amongst topics like the economy, healthcare, climate crisis, immigration, gun policy, where Joe Biden is head and shoulders above everyone else. His lead on Sanders is 34 points, whereas, you know, it's in the single digits in pretty much every other category in this poll. So clearly voters see Biden in a different field almost when comparing the candidates on foreign policy.
It is possible, though, by the way, that like this de-escalates and the idea that
I mean, we know how quickly things move on from the news cycle, right? Impeachment. Nancy Pelosi holding the impeachment charges has almost been forgotten about, it seems like, after
people go. Qu'est-ce que c'est, impeachment?
Impeachment.
What was that?
Impeachment.
I think that's a sign that we're nearing the end of the podcast. But what were you going to say, Nate?
But look, obviously things that can develop. There can be escalations. There can be de-escalations. There can be further attacks by the U.S. There can be further attacks by Iran. There can be third parties that get involved. If we get to a point where Bush is giving a speech at the State of the Union,
I was going to say
deliberate.
Somewhat
halfway deliberate Freudian slip. If Trump is in the State of the Union saying, okay, you know, yellow cake and Niger and all this stuff, and we have to like mount a force to actually have a invasion of Iran, right? That's a very different political circumstance. And if you just kind of have this happen, and then Americans have heightened fear.
Do you think Biden's vote on the Iraq war will be a problem for him? Or is it just...
It's like, making the rounds on Twitter right now that Biden at an event basically suggested that he had opposed the Iraq war.
Is that dumb? Shouldn't he just be like, I was misled?
I guess Biden's ahead now, so who are we to question him? But like, to me, it would seem like that would be a great opportunity for Biden to not be this stubborn... How old is he now? 77-year-old?
Yeah.
And be like, that was one of the biggest mistakes of my career, and I learned from it, and that makes me even more trepidatious.
Yeah. No politician from that generation who voted for the Iraq War has really figured out a way to properly...
Hillary Clinton. I thought she did that.
It's still a vote that haunted her.
Don't you just frame it as blaming being manipulated by the executive branch?
Did.
Would you say anything else, right?
I think there's probably also this... I'm sure that Biden will course correct, but I think there's this natural human instinct of defensiveness.
Yeah.
Of like, well, you don't understand the position I was in. And maybe he didn't articulate that
Well, and also,
that's probably what he is trying to convey.
Again, this is a decision that led to a war and many, many, many hundreds of thousands of deaths, right? And so
there is a through line you can draw there.
I'm saying, but there's not. It's not just you. This is a case where you're not just talking about a public rationale or a public justification. For people who were involved in this on either side, I would guess you have an inner rationale and an inner justification, which I imagine would make trip ups like this more likely.
All right. Well, as Nate mentioned, this could escalate. This could de-escalate. We obviously don't know what's going to happen next, but we're going to be tracking it here on the podcast. But that's it for today. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
And two things before we leave you. First, we have a live show coming up next week on January 16th in Washington, D.C. Head over to 538.com/live to get tickets and details. Also, before we go, I want to give everyone a heads up that we're launching an exciting audio documentary series in this podcast feed later this week. It's called The Primaries Project, and the idea is that our system for choosing presidential candidates is the result of happenstance and reactionary decision-making and was never rigorously thought through. So over three episodes, we're going to look at how our system came to be, what the consequences of that system are, and then lastly, how it could be different. Here's a little preview.
I think it's really telling that almost no other democracy chooses its party candidates in this sort of way.
In 1980, the establishment kind of strikes back.
The strategy and upper reaches of the Republican Party was simple until recently. Demand and get unity behind George W. Bush.
We're going to take back the Democratic Party first.
What the internet has done is introduce into the process an element of this being a reality TV show.
Party elites were unable to come together and coalesce around a candidate.
I am your voice.
Look for The Primaries Project in your feeds this Thursday. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.